This is an audio presentation from www.podcasts.ie.
You're very welcome to James Lawless page here on podcast.ie. And just before I introduce James, I'd like to say thank you very much indeed to the Roscommon Herald who have allowed us a bit of space to come in and record. James, you've driven all the way down from County Dublin, or is it County Kildare to County Roscommon?
County Kildare, actually, Joe, from Leixlip. But it was a beautiful drive, 2 hours.
Not so too bad.
Not too bad at all.
And you have a connection with the Roscommon Herald. And
I do, my son-in-law. Right. Yeah, is the sports editor here.
So writing somewhere, it's not in the blood because he's not a blood relation, but it's
no.
in the family.
Well, it's in the family now. Yeah. That's right.
Just so that we give an idea, you have 5 novels and 1 collection of poetry. You've also got plays. But I wanted to talk to you also, you have a study of poetry. Is that a fair description of...
It is. Yes, it was a book called... It is a book called Clearing the Tangled Wood. Mm. Poetry as a Way of Seeing the World. And it's actually a study of what poetry means.
Right. From your perspective or...
Well, when I write a book, I write to find things out.
Right.
And if I want to find out something... I start writing. That's what I do.
Right.
It's not only about poetry, though. It's about creativity itself. What is creativity? So it's an examination of those areas of creativity and perception, because every chapter in the book begins with seeing, you know, seeing through the poet's eyes, seeing the world through the poet's eyes, seeing in the marketplace. For example, there's a chapter called Seeing Ice for the First Time, this sense of wonder that's in the poet's eyes and in his perception.
Right.
And so I suppose it's a different way of seeing the world. And perhaps in this world today, which is so taken up with economics, to stand back and look at the world in a sort of broader perspective than just purely economic is good, perhaps. It's reflective and it gives us alternative ways of seeing.
Okay. It sounds like a very academic, and maybe would it be accessible then for somebody who wants to do... get into poetry.
Yes, well, it's doing well with reviews.
I've noticed there's almost like a who's who: John Montague, Brendan Kennelly, Thomas Kinsella, Noonan Ligonel, and a person who we all know at the moment called Michael D. Higgins,
yes,
President of Ireland. Not everybody gets their national president to do a review on the book. And he said, wonderfully compelling and elegantly written book. That's no mean compliment, really, is it?
No, it's not. So it was very encouraging to get those compliments. And so it is for people who poets, but it's also for creative writers, you know, and understanding the whole idea of what creativity is, and even giving some guidelines on how to, you know, maximize your own creative potential.
Right.
So there are elements of that in
there. So when you say maximize your own creative, because there's so many books out there, how to write this and how to write that. This is not about how to write, how to get inside your own mind, I suppose.
It is, exactly, It's how to get this preparedness, if you like. Wordsworth called it preparedness to be receptive to the creative impulse. And that's what it explores.
Right.
Yeah.
Would it be fair to say that you are only taking this from your own perspective, or was there an awful lot of research on your behalf to see how others might think? Because I have no idea how the mind of a poet works, and I've met so many of them. I've been very fortunate. But their minds work completely differently, don't they?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, I did a lot of research on it, as you probably see from the bibliography at the back. So, and it's drawable, you know, in the sense that it's not confined to Irish poets.
It wasn't written originally for...
The Irish section was actually requested
by the publisher, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, the Irish section was requested by the publisher. And there's a lot of, as I say, drawable poetry where... I have a degree in Spanish and Irish, so I did my own translations from the Spanish poets like Lorca. I have a special section, say, on Lorca and Salinas. And then the Irish poets as well, unless otherwise stated, I translated from them as well.
Okay.
So, and then there's a section on Russian poets.
And
a particular area on, say, Pasternak, a poet I admire quite a lot.
Is there a common thread in the mind of a poet?
As you say, Joe, every person is different. Every person has a different perception, and I suppose you're mining the individual perception of a person. But one influence too, I suppose, was from the world of art. ways of seeing paintings even. You know, you can apply that, say, to ways of seeing the poet's view of the world.
Right.
And there's a, you know, I remember Virginia Woolf used to say, write slant, you know. In other words, you have a slanted view of the world. It's not, you're not looking directly at the world. You're looking at it from a different perspective. I suppose it gives you alternative vision.
Okay.
If you look, instead of just going along with the typical, as I mentioned before, the economic view of the world, the material view of the world, it just gives you alternative visions, you know.
Mm.
And that's what I was attempting to do in the book.
There wouldn't be too many poets who could afford to look at something from an economic, in other words, from the financial rewards.
That's right.
The poet is not, generally not interested in that side of things at
that's
all.
That's right. That's
and
right.
Probably just as well for
yes.
so many.
So,
although
so yeah, so it, in other words, it validates the poet in society. In other words, it's saying that the poet has, you know, a valid place in our world. You know, he's not just something peripheral to our world.
The biography on your website reads almost, I mentioned the who's who of poets who appreciated Clearing the Tangled Wood, but if you like, your first steps and your continuing steps in writing reads like a who's who of all the top magazines and literary collections and poetry collections and all sorts of stuff there, the Cecil Day Lewis Play Awards, you've got all sorts of things there that some people would be happy to have two or three of. I think there's about 20 or 30 listed here. Are you a completely dedicated, avid writer? Do you have to write?
I do. I have to write, yeah. I think it's a condition. You know, I remember my sister-in-law said once, well, that's your hobby. And I sort of disagreed with the word hobby. I believe it's a condition. I don't believe I'm happy. Or not that anyone is ever really happy, but content, perhaps, unless I'm in a writing situation, you know. And I believe that, you know, that writing is a discipline as well. And I believe it's a vocation too. And I believe that you can be a dilettante. In other words, you can dabble into it and just be, you know, which is great, you know, just read bits and pieces. But I believe if you're dedicated to an art, that you have to be totally committed to it. And that requires a lot of sacrifice and a lot of discipline. But if that's what you believe, that's what you do. You do what you believe in.
Before we move on to your novels, you should mention that you also have a collection of poetry, and that takes on almost like four sides in the sense that it's urban and rural and English and Irish.
That's right.
Did you come up and say, did you say to yourself, I'm going to write this book about urban and, you know, did you take the facets, or were they all these elements there and you look back at them and said, that's the way that collection is going to work?
That's right. Yeah, I think the latter. I think they just evolved that way because I was always into Irish. The ideology of Irish, you know, I was brought up on an all-Irish class, Irish, you know, not an all-Irish school, but an all-Irish class, you know, where everything was taught through Irish. And a lot of that is examined in the first novel, Peeling Oranges. So the idea of writing in Irish was there always. And the urban, of course, I'm a product of the urban world. And then, of course, when I started delving into the country side, I started writing poems based in, say, Kildare or West Cork.
Right.
So they were the rural.
But we should also mention the fact that when you say Kildare, you're not too far from the heart of the city of Dublin in Kildare. I mean, it's what, half an hour or so
that's
away.
Right. That's right.
Very accessible.
Yeah.
So you'd have cityscapes as well.
That's right. I love the being on the periphery of both worlds. You know, I love being slightly outside the city and slightly outside the rural. So I suppose that is the role of an artist or a writer, really, to stand on the side of things. You know, Kavanagh always talked about that. Remember, not being able to go to the dance. Remember, he had to stand and observe as the writer.
Mm.
And this idea, I think there is a little role like that you have to stand aside a little bit. It's like going back to our talk about the vision in the poetry, that you have to stand aside a little bit to get a view, or perhaps an objective view of things, insofar as one is able to get an objective view of things, you know.
Yeah. Before we started the interview, you mentioned just again that you have a place down in West Cork, and you say when you get there, you stay well away from emails and stuff like that, that you just don't want to be distracted from your writing. On the other hand, how far away from your writing can you get? And, you know, is there a point where, obviously, if there's a family wedding, you have a grandchild probably christened and stuff like that, are you away from the writing even in the family situation, or when you go to buy a new suit or something like that?
Yeah, I think a little part of you, a little compartment inside your head is always away But you participate. It's very important to socialise as a writer, of course. But there's always a little part of you that's sort of reclusive. I think as a writer, you have to cultivate a solitude, and you have to take that solitude on. And of course, you have to be careful maybe not to delve too deeply. We've had artists like Virginia Woolf, Sylvia Plath, and others who maybe went a little too deeply into things.
Yeah.
So the whole secret, I think, as a writer is to get some sort of a balance, which is probably an impossibility, but to be careful not to go too deeply into areas.
Yeah. In relation to maybe somebody writing a poem, and it so far hasn't happened in, you know, from the printed perspective, that somebody writes a poem about a certain person, for instance, somebody that you once worked with or whatever. But, you know, if somebody sees themselves mentioned in a poem rather complimentary, they will be quite delighted. On the other hand, when it comes to your novels, the people who might have influenced the characters in there, maybe not in the right way. How do you get away from saying, oh, that was shamey or whatever it might, you know what I mean? Somebody has influenced the character and not in a very complimentary way. Something bad about a person that you expanded on. Do you understand what
I do, Joe, yes.
How do you avoid that? How do you avoid them finding out that you based that character on them?
Yeah, well, I think all characters are composites in fiction. Mm. You know, they're composites of many aspects.
Right.
And also there's a Dickensian element, perhaps sometimes, of caricature where you are hyperbolical about the character. So you've taken them so much that they're maybe a little bit exaggerated out of the humdrum. And so they may be unrecognisable in that respect. But I think that what happens with real people and real characters is they sort of distill themselves in your head, and they come out, in, as I say, as composites. So you have bits and pieces of all sorts of real people mixed up, but then you've created a type of Frankenstein.
Yeah, but I mean, is that not almost like saying that, for instance, somebody who has a limb might work, who worked, should we say, for the Garda Síochána Conna and was married to a barrister, and at some point then you go and you're writing somebody else's character and you go, oh yeah, and the limp, and can you mix them up and get the wrong
I don't think you can do it Lego style, no. I do,
but in the sense of you confusing yourself as hang on, did he or did he not have the limp, or was he or was he not married to the barrister?
I think what happens is with all my novels they start off as research, because as I was saying to you earlier, what prompts me to write a novel is I want to find out something. So it's actually to try and discover something myself that I write it. And I find then with characters, they sort of evolve from the research. You know, the actual take shape.
Yeah.
I think McGahern talked about osmosis, you know, from the idea of doing an awful lot of reading, that the actual writing then just sort of flows out of you after a while. But reading an awful lot. I think you have to read an awful lot to write.
And is there no danger that you'll be influenced by what you've read and almost copy whatever it is you've read last, or be too influenced by it?
I know what you're saying. I think that my reading is so diffuse, so varied that, you know, it'd be different perhaps if I was just reading one writer all the time or something like that, but that it comes from so many writers that my own voice, that we often talk about the voice of a writer, that you work on that. You are imitative of writers, I think, when you're starting off, but as you progress with your own writing, you develop your own voice, I think.
Looking at the titles of your five novels, and we'd say For the Love of Anna would conjure up a certain picture. The Avenue, yes, I can see where that might be going. Finding Penelope, I can get an idea where that might be. It could be wrong. And also with Knowing Women. But Peeling Oranges, that's a title that I couldn't really imagine what it could be about. I would have no clue.
Right.
That was your first novel, wasn't it?
My first novel, and it wasn't the first title. I had a title called Perceiving Oranges. This is going back to our perception again. I thought it was a brilliant title. And the publisher said, no one's going to buy a book called Perceiving Oranges. And so it was changed. The idea of Perceiving Oranges came from a philosopher called José Ortega Gasset, a Spanish philosopher, and he said something which always stuck in my head. He says, no one has ever seen an orange. And the more I thought of it, I thought it was absolutely brilliant to do a perception, because as we know, an orange is a sphere. So when you look at an orange, you can only see one part of it. You can't see the back of it.
Okay.
And that ties in with what I was trying to do with the novel, as I was with the other book, Clearing Tanglewood, of the whole idea that we can only have a limited sense of the world as individuals. And this, of course, is an anti-totalitarian idea. You know, the totalitarian or the dictators tell you they see the whole world. So what I was trying to do with, say, Peeling Oranges was get to the truth of something. Peeling Oranges is about a paternal quest. This guy, his father is a diplomat in early Franco Spain, and I did a lot of research. When I started that novel, the archives in Bishop Street had just opened to the public, and loads of censored and censured stuff became available. So I devoured all that stuff, and I got stuff on the Spanish and Irish Civil Wars, which comes into this. And the guy anyway discovers that his father was impotent. So therefore, he wasn't his father. So he has to go searching through Spain and Northern Ireland to find out who his father was. And that gave me an opportunity then to explore the idea of perception, because his mother, this perhaps comes to the title now, his mother didn't want to tell him anything about his past. Okay. And she used to smoke Sweet Afton, and she used to have a wheeze. And to
ease, these are untipped cigarettes we'd often have. Yeah,
that's right,
yeah,
in those days.
Aware, I think, yeah. Yeah.
And to ease the wheeze, he used to peel an orange for her. And so the orange then was for that obvious purpose, but then, of course, there was the other meaning of like peeling the onion, to your peeling back to get to the truth of things. So
the layers.
The layers.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was it.
Okay. And Finding Penelope went back to the Irish-Spanish connection as well, but in this time in the underworld of the drugs, and I have to assume, and probably rightly so, that you know little or nothing about the world of drugs until you went researching.
I did a bit of research, yeah. What actually prompted that was not the drugs so much. It was the whole idea of romance novels. You know, Don Quixote was written by Cervantes, mm-hmm. as a sort of a satire on the proliferation of these novels of chivalry that were written at the time. Thousands and thousands of these novels proliferated around Spain, and he was satirizing them. And I was doing something similar, attempting, in humility, to do something similar about all the romance novels that were proliferating in our society today. And so I created this character, Penelope Eames, who was a romance novelist, and she made a good bit of money, so she was able to buy her villa in Spain, and she wanted to get away there from a very, very oppressive father and a drug-addicted brother.
Okay.
And so when she went there, she thought she was escaping it all, and of course the brother follows her, and then that's the connection then with the drugs, because he's involved with drugs.
Okay.
And so the world, you know, opens up then, so it's not all escapism for Penelope, and she has to deal with a lot of issues.
Also dark issues, I suppose.
Yeah, a lot of dark issues, yeah. But one of the things that happens towards the end is when she grows in maturity, and she becomes a very mature writer at the end. And she realises, like, her agent used to be ringing her up all the time, don't forget the happy ending, you know.
Mm.
You have to have the happy ending in your next book. And she realised that, you know, to write that sort of formulaic fiction wasn't her. And in the end, she starts writing a different type of story towards the end. So she, from all the terrible experiences she has,
it was the book she was writing.
She comes.
And in that sense, would you say that, you know, people like to, particularly when it comes to libraries or bookshops and reviewers, that you would say he's a romantic novelist, he's a historical novelist, he's a fantasy novelist or whatever. And I'm sure most of the novelists would say, well, actually, it's a little bit of everything in my books. Would that be where you'd like to be?
Yes, well, for example, my second novel was called For Love of Anna. Mm. And, you know, somebody said once, if you have love in the title, it's going to sell.
Right.
But Anna has a double meaning. Anna is a ballerina. So it is a love story, in a way. It's a romance. This guy, Guido van Thule, who is a philosophy student, falls in love with this ballerina called Anna Zweig. And I created a fictitious city for it, because at the time, it was during the time of the Celtic Tiger. And this book, the whole research for that book was about capitalism and what alternatives there were to capitalism, which was a monolith.
Okay.
You know, yeah. Because the opposite, Russia had just collapsed. So there was no opposition, ideational politics in the Labour Party and Socialist parties had all collapsed. So it was almost a norm. Everybody accepted during the Celtic Tiger that capitalism ruled the roost. And there was there didn't seem to be any ideological questioning of capitalism, which is what I grew up with, say, in the 60s. We were more ideological, I felt, now that you could disagree.
Yeah.
And what happened then was this book, For Love of Anna, deals with corruption in high places in the case of a high court judge. But the word Anna itself is an acronym for anarchists of the new age.
All right. Okay.
So that's the little ploy in it, if you like.
Knowing Women, 2013. What was the first thoughts on that?
Right.
What do you need to do?
What prompted that, Joe, was, you know, the way we were bombarded with all the paedophilia cases, non-stop. And there was a couple of cases that were in the media where the cases were proven wrong. And now, I think it's terrible that these cases come up and totally behind the conviction of paedophiles.
Absolutely, yeah, no, I think I know where you're going to come from.
But I was just imagining, and I think this is the role of the artist to imagine what happened. What would happen if an innocent man was tainted?
Everyone thought that.
Yeah,
yeah.
And hence the character Lawrence J. Bembo was created. Now, what prompted me to write it was I'm a great fan of Brian Moore, the writer. And I just reread The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearn. And I was very moved by the woman in that story who was very vulnerable in society. And she was an unmarried woman and she had her own fantasies and her weakness was alcohol.
Right.
So I was thinking, what about if I create this vulnerable man and make his weakness sex? So sexuality was the weakness in Bembo. Now, Bembo was not a holy character by any means.
Right.
He was into a bit of porn, a bit of all sorts of things. He was a bachelor.
Right.
So anything but a saintly type of character, but not a bad person either, you see. And this is what I wanted to create, was an ordinary person.
Right.
And he wins the lotto and his posh brother and his upwardly mobile wife out in Malahide hear about it. So they want the money from him and he used to go to read stories, you know, little fairy tales to his niece Lydia, and they accuse Bembo of interfering with Lydia. And this is the dilemma in the novel. This is what Bembo has to make a decision. And he's very awkward with women. They sort of ridicule him where he works in Print 21. He's a graphic artist.
Right.
And there's a Miss U Ryan who really ridicules him. But the actual decision. There was one person who did love him, a girl called Deborah. He felt she and her mother were coming too heavy on him, possessively, you know, that getting engaged and all that sort of thing, and he pulled out of that. But it makes him think about her towards the end of the novel as well, because he thinks he's fallen for this Belarusian pole dancer, and he starts giving her loads of money and gifts and all this sort of thing in his naivety. He discovers, maybe I shouldn't tell too much of what happens. But
Be careful.
Yeah.
Because I'm looking forward to reading it now, I have to say.
He discovers that his brother and wife are not what they appear to be.
Right.
So maybe I better not say too much more.
All right,
about the title, Joe, Knowing Women, because some people, you know, have mentioned that even though it's called Knowing Women, it's really about a man.
Mm.
But the knowing women in the title is, of course, that he deals with women who are knowing.
Right.
Very knowing.
So, and okay.
It's like Anna, it's got a double meaning.
He understands what he's
and then
he's
with. Trying to know women as well, because he's very ill at ease and he doesn't really understand women. And yet then on the other hand, he's meeting women who are knowing.
Mm. That's the thing is, you know, if somebody says, Jack was accused of robbing the bank, but he was found innocent. Tommy was accused of this, that and the other. But when it comes to paedophilia, I think it would always be, they couldn't prove it.
Yeah.
As opposed to that, he was innocent.
Yeah.
He got away with it. And, I'm interested.
Yeah, and the danger, one of the solicitors, he goes to a solicitor, and the idea that no smoke without fire. Sort of that. And I think once the taint, what I wanted to explore is, once someone is tainted in any way, guilty anyway in the eyes of the public? Do people go to the trouble of finding out?
Mm.
And it must be dreadful for, say, a couple of people in the media who did come up in the media, and who were innocent, and yet the taint is there.
I think it's the one crime that if you are accused of, it will taint.
That's the danger. Forever. That's what I wanted to explore in that book. Yeah.
James, it's been a total pleasure talking to you, and this is our first meeting, and hopefully the first of many, and I hope that you'll do some readings for us in separate podcasts. For the moment, James Lawless, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
You have been listening to a presentation from podcast.ie. Voices from Ireland.